This. Thank you, darling. And as my good friend Curtis Lamb brings the platform up, let me just real quickly say a special happy birthday. My mom's birthday was yesterday, so y'all sing happy birthday to her. She came in, she's on the front row today. So anyway, yeah, she waves, yeah. My brothers and I had a pool on how she would respond when I did that, and I won. I told her she'd turn around and wave at everybody. All right, let's sing happy birthday, okay? Let's sing happy birthday to her, ready? Happy birthday to you. Y'all can call her Joan. Happy birthday to you. I was right. Happy birthday, dear Joan. Happy birthday to you. Speaking of my mom, the next two in the series of blonde jokes, I've got them. You guys hit me, okay? All right. Two blonde friends are walking down the street, right? One notices a compact, the little thing, you know, that women use for makeup, right? On the sidewalk, and they lean down to pick it up. She opens it, looks in the mirror, and says, this person looks familiar. Well, the second blonde friend says, well, look, let me see it. So the first blonde hands her the compact. The second blonde looks in the mirror and says, you dummy, that's me. Anyway, all right, here's another one, all right? Good, all right, ladies, you know, I've seen some of you. You are really good at doing carpentry work and such like this. So a story of a couple of friends, ladies named Lynn and Judy, doing some carpentry work on a Habitat for Humanity house, doing some good stuff. Lynn was pulling down the siding and would reach into her pouch, pull out a nail, and either toss it over her shoulder or nail it in. Judy, figuring this was worth looking into, asked, what are you throwing these nails away for? Lynn explained, when I pull a nail out of my pouch, about half of them have the head on the wrong end, and I just throw them away. Judy got completely upset and said, you moron, those nails aren't defective. They're for the other side of the house. Okay, let me ask you a question. All right, listen. Double-sided hit. What does that mean to you? What does that mean to you? What does it mean to you? Let me give you an example. Elvis, Hound Dog, and Don't Be Cruel. Uh-huh. The Beatles, does anybody know one of the double-sided hits that they had? We Can Work It Out, and She Was a Day Tripper. Remember that one? All right, there's another one. Ricky Nelson. This is the real trivia. If anybody gets this one, you'll get a $50 gift card somewhere. I just decided on that, so I don't know where it's going to be yet. Anybody know that one? Ricky Nelson. That's a good guess, Charlie. Wasn't Garden Party. Garden Party came a little bit after this one. What's that? Traveling Man. What was the other one? Come on, Sonny. Come on, baby. No, not Cows Neil Sedaka. Come on. No, I'm just joking. Well, hello, Mary Lou. That was the one. Anyway, yeah, Kyle. Yeah, no, that's because there are no real hits today, and the only time we really had hits was when we had 45. So anyway, I'll just play with you. Yeah, we're talking today about some more of the aspects, some of the attributes of friends. And, you know, I want you to be a double-sided hit. Now, what am I talking about here? For you to be a double-sided hit, you've got to learn what to look for in friends, but you've also got to know how to be a friend, right? You see, double-sided hits in the friend world are relatively rare, okay? We got plenty of people who know what to look for, or they want people to be their friends, but in reality, oftentimes, they don't know how to exude those attributes themselves. So to be a well-rounded person, we've got to kind of be that double-sided hit kind of person, knowing what to look for in others, because you know what? You can be a better friend the better friends you have around you. Does that make sense? The Bible says that iron sharpens iron, right? And you know, when we are with each other doing these things and living out these attributes and the personality traits that Jesus has demonstrated for us and the friends that Jesus had around him and how they demonstrated that, and we can learn from those, then we can be a whole lot better in the social aspects of our lives, can't we? We're going to go to the story today in John chapter 11 as we're moving through John, and we're going to actually move back. We've been in John chapter 12. We're going to go back to chapter 11, and we're going to look a little bit at the story of when he raised Lazarus from the dead. Now, we're not going to actually look at the actual raising or the resurrection of Lazarus, but we're going to look at what happened on either side of that. And that's the main focus. We're going to look at a scenario, a context, where we see a number of different groups of people, Jesus' friends, as well as some folks that didn't know him. And we're going to nail down about five or six things, attributes of friendship that we need to be aware of and that we need to be looking for. So as we do that, I want us to real quick, we're going to move quickly through a packed story. And before we get into that, I want to make a statement that I believe that friendship today is a lot different than it was when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, before I was born, at the turn of the 20th century. Would you agree? Friendship looks a lot different today than it did back then. And let me give you at least three major trends that have kind of contributed to this. This is kind of Bud's research, so you know, if you ask me for sources and such, well, I'm it. But I've actually just read, you know, just reading and stuff like that I've done, and just kind of give you a way that I summarize what's happened socially and in terms of relationships over time. First of all, there's the spiritual trend, the spiritual aspects, things that have happened spiritually since largely the last part of the 19th century, when theologians, theology schools began moving away from what we would think today, we would call more conservative theology, which would basically assume that, you know, the Bible itself is inerrant in its word, you know, and that every, you know, it's all there for us to use, and it's all inspired, and it's all, you know, it's all what the big, you know, what big God gave us to live on. And out of that comes absolute standards of moral right and wrong. In the, you know, back in that 19th century or so, liberal theology began a foothold in seminaries and theology schools, producing, you know, pastors, etc., that led churches, and they had more of a liberal idea about theology. And so what that did was that tended for the most part to lead to what we might call a religious pluralism. In other words, it began to elevate false religions or false ideas about Jesus and about Christianity, and kind of put it societally on an equal plane with Christianity. And as a result, people began to lose a little bit of what it meant to really have a solid relationship. We began to lose the idea that Jesus, or not lose it, because I'm not saying it was ever there exclusively, but the idea of Jesus being the only way to heaven and the relationship with Jesus modeling the relationship that we are to have with others began to lose some traction during that time. And so that's kind of a synopsis of the spiritual trend as I've seen it. It led to more of a spiritual view of individualism. All right, it's funny because, you know, I told you I went to the Temptations and Four Tops the other night. And as the Tops completed their set, they sang My Way, all right, the Sinatra song. They changed some words to actually give God's grace credit for their success. But if you look at that song and you realize that that's really, that song, a great song, I love it. But in reality, it's kind of a humanist national anthem. You know, I did it my way. You know, it's all about me. And that's the individual aspect that we've seen in the spiritual trend over the past 150 or so, maybe even 200 years or so. The second trend I want to note is an economic trend. Since World War II, America has enjoyed an unprecedented period of economic prosperity, right? Would you agree with that? World War II, coming out of that, there were a lot of things. We were rebuilding Germany, and so a lot of folks thought, well, let's find ways to help rebuild America because we've been through a very draining war. And so something called consumer credit began to take a real foothold in American culture and society. Before long, you could buy almost anything. It started out with appliance stores, right? And before long, you could buy almost anything on credit. And so what happened was, back before we got a little too loose with credit and we got too reckless with it, that helped lead to real economic prosperity. Well, this made, for example, home ownership very possible for just about everybody, right? Good thing. Home ownership, single family dwellings, good thing, wonderful. The downside is that too began to cause us to look at our homes as our fortresses. And going beyond the walls of the home to others in the neighborhood. Now, it's gotten progressively more like this now in the last part of the 20th century and even now. Of course, we can still remember Mayberry, right? And places like that where this was not a problem. In the neighborhoods, people did know everybody. But particularly in the last 20 to 30 years, what's happened is our homes have become our fortresses. We tend not to move beyond them. And even people in our neighborhood, we don't get to talk to very much. We don't know them very well. And so that's been a trend. Another trend of the economic prosperity has been the mobility that we see in industry. I can move to another place to get another job if I'd like to get a promotion or to get another job altogether. Or if I'm unemployed, I can go somewhere else and get another job. At least that used to be that way before September of 2008, right? And what that has done, that mobility has caused us to lose touch with friends that maybe we have had. The nature of the friendship is different. And so now, as I've talked to a couple people recently who've had to move on, they dread so much the idea of trying to rebuild what they already have here in so many different ways. Friend networks, acquaintances, just knowing who to go to for this and that and the other. So economic prosperity is a great thing. Mobility can be a great thing for truly upwardly mobile people. But many people take advantage of this and they lose continuity in relationships. The third trend is that what I'm going to call technological trend. It's a technological trend. And we kind of did a little video on the spoof, right? We spoofed that a few minutes ago. But in reality, it's not much of a spoof, is it? Technology has really brought us into the social networking world, which has really caused us to redefine what friend means, doesn't it? And we don't really know what it means anymore. And in many ways, it's caused a reframing of this. There's some good trends here because, you know, social networking, for example, does allow us to partially overcome the disadvantages of the mobility problem, right? I can still stay in touch with folks that I might have been friends with when I lived in this location or lived in that location, et cetera, and all that good stuff. But what I'm afraid that technology has done, it's caused us to reframe friendship in a way that it was never meant to be reframed. And we wind up substituting something that in reality never has a chance of replacing relationships and friendships. So understand these three trends and the ways that they have shaped American culture. And the fact that as we look at friendship today, we're going to be looking back kind of at some attributes, some traits. And these traits and these attributes we're going to look at, I'm not saying that they can't be espoused or exhibited in the context of these trends, but it makes it much more difficult. Now, I will say, particularly as it relates to technological advances, I want to share with you the basically four types of communication, and they're not on your screen. I'm sorry, I just kind of put this together this morning. If you want, I'll go slow if you want to write it down. And the level of richness in the communication. All right, the richest conversation, the richest communication is carried forth how? Face to face, right? Face to face. Face to face communication is by far, hands down, the richest type of communication that we could ever have. Now, why is that? It's because we have both voice and visual, or verbal and visual expression that is able to be made to the other party, or to each other, right? We have the advantage of voice, right? We hear the emotion in the voice, the inflection in the voice. We also get the advantage of what? The body language. Right, that's huge, because your body language really is going to communicate so much more than we ever give it credit for, right? There's no question about that. So that's by far the richest form of communication. The second richest form of communication would be voice only, okay? For example, telephone, okay? You're hearing my voice, I'm hearing your voice. Now, the disadvantage is I can't see your body language. The advantage is I can hear the emotion and the expression in your voice, okay? Not nearly as good as face-to-face, but voice-only is a whole lot better than anything else other than face-to-face. Would you agree? Yeah. I mean, we could say, okay, visual-only, but if I'm sitting here moving my mouth and you can't hear what I'm saying, right, and you only read my body language, it doesn't really mean a whole lot, right? So that's the second piece. That's the second richest level or form of conversation. The third is what I'm going to call written informational communication. Written informational communication. Okay? Now, the problem with this is, and I'll say informational, when we write something to somebody simply for the purposes of giving them the facts. No emotion involved, right? Nothing like that, but the facts. Just the facts, please, ma'am, right? As Jack Webb used to say on Dragnet. You know, just informational stuff. Written communication, when information needs to be passed, can be a good thing. That may be totally harmless. It's not as good as face-to-face, not as good as voice only, but written informational can be passed on, or information can be written on, passed on in a written format. I'm talking about the type of communication that does not require a response. Does that make sense? Does not require a response. For example, email can be used very well for this. Okay? Some other means of communication can be used very well for this. Right? And so that tends to be the third most rich type of communication. The fourth, and then kind of, to me, kind of at the bottom of the totem pole with regard to richness of communication, is what I'm going to call written, conversational, and emotional communication. Okay? This is extremely hazardous. Written, conversational, and when I say written, I'm not talking about just on a piece of paper. I'm talking about electronically written, too. Type, okay? Typed. All right, however you want to do it. Text, whatever. Okay? However you recreate what you would write, okay? This can tend to be the most hazardous type of communication. And we got to be real careful because this can become very, very detrimental in understanding what friends are. Now, the problem with written communication that is conversational and emotional in nature is that you have no room for expression of emotions. You have no room for expression of body language or the voice to really understand. Plus, whenever anything is written, you're at the mercy of the ability of the person to communicate in a written fashion. Can I tell you this? That there are really good written communicators are relatively few in the world today. Our educational system just is not necessarily designed to do a great job of producing them. Now, there are a lot of them, but you know there are a lot of them who are not. And so unless you take lots of time to really analyze what you're typing, what you're texting, what you're writing, whatever the case might be, you run the hazard of somebody misunderstanding what you're saying. Okay? Now, can I get over-emotional in a conversation face-to-face? Sure you can. But that is a true representation of where you are at that point in time. Okay? So understand these things as you think about communicating. Because in every friend relationship, communication is key. Right? Communication is key. You know, in the work that I do with companies and stuff, always, when we're figuring out what needs to be done, in every single case, the company or the organization, the church, the government agency says this: we have got to fix our what? Communications. As a communicative society, we collectively suck at communication. Basically, we do. We really do. In every case. People, and you know what? When we don't get people information they want, they get upset, right? They get, you know, they get hurt. They feel left out, etc. When we communicate in the wrong way, people can also be offended, right? And oftentimes, we don't really know that the offense has occurred, okay? So just kind of keep those things in mind. Do your best to try to keep as much of your communication as possible in those areas that are the richest. That way you can minimize misunderstandings, etc. Well, let's go to John chapter 11. Jesus now is in Bethany. He's only a couple of miles away from Jerusalem when he would make the triumphant entry into Jerusalem to start what we call the Passion Week, at the end of which, obviously, he would be experienced crucifixion and then resurrection on Sunday. So in this story, we see about a man who, and his name was Lazarus, good friend of Jesus, and as we saw the last couple of weeks, Mary and Martha were sisters. And they lived here in Bethany, were pretty prominent citizens. Word got to Jesus that the one you love, Lazarus, he was told, the sisters got word to Jesus and said, the one you love, our brother Lazarus, is dead. He's died. And so Jesus basically said, this sickness will not end in death. This is for God's glory, etc. But Jesus had emotion. Jesus was emotional about the situation as well, himself. And so when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was for 2 more days. Well, I said a few moments ago, he was told he was dead. He wasn't. He was told it was sick. He was sick. But Jesus had already known that Lazarus was going to die. But he said, this story will not end in death, ultimately. So I want us to look at the first few of some attributes of friendship that we see in this story, in the people that are here, all of whom are Jesus' friends in chapter 11. And then we're going to go to chapter 12, where we're going to see some things about those who are not his friends. So what am I going to look for in a friend, and how am I going to be a friend? Here's the first thing. We want to look for, and we want to exhibit, the courage to move forward in difficult situations. We want to have the courage to move forward in difficult situations. You know what? If I want to be a friend to you, I've got to have some courage, right? And I want you to have courage, because there are going to be times in my life when I need courage, right? And I need people around me who are going to foster that courage for me, who are going to what's the word? You know, here's the funny. We think about encourage. Do we really understand what encourage means? And when we encourage someone, what are we doing? We are trying to pass on to them courage. That's the word. To encourage someone is to give them courage. You ever thought about that? So I want to encourage you. So therefore, I want to give you courage. Why? Because, you know, courage is something we never have enough of. We're always going to need courage, no matter what the situation might be. Jesus said to his disciples, let's go back to Judea. Well, the disciples knew that that would not be a good idea for them, because he knew that there were people there who were after Jesus. But Rabbi, they said in verse 8, a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you are going back there? Now, here, the disciples did not do a whole lot to encourage Jesus to move forward in the way he said he needed to move. What were they more about doing? They were trying to discourage him from going, right? Because they saw in the practical realm, they saw people there who were going to try to kill him, who were going to try to take him out. But here's the point. If you want to be a friend, and if you want to have a friend, you got to be one who is willing to have courage and to encourage in order to help people move forward through difficult situations. Because all of us have learned in life that the difficult situations will come, right? It's not if they come, it's when they come. So the question is, are you and I going to have a friendship framework developed in preparation for those times? That's why we encourage small groups here. That's why we encourage you to get involved in ministry teams around a project or a job or something like that, in order for you to have the opportunity to have others around you who can share in those times with you. Can I tell you that long time ago, we got too big for any one person, any staff member or whatever, to take care of all the needs that you're going to have in the situation that might be difficult. Besides, that would be anti-biblical anyway. The Bible says that all Christ followers, right, are to serve others and to give encouragement to the others. All of us are to be ministers to one another. Not one paid minister, not one paid staff member, not one deacon head or elder head or whatever, all of us together. That is the biblical model for the church. Anything else would be total consumerism. Does that make sense? I'm just looking for what I can get for me. No, you need to be looking for what you can give to others. That's what the biblical model of care is all about. And friendship, that's why Jesus, one of the reasons Jesus gave us the idea of smaller local congregations, right? So that we could be the expressions of Jesus Christ, all of us to one another. Go read Ephesians 4, Romans 12, very clear in the biblical model of the church. Here's the second thing I want to make sure that I would look for, but I also need to make sure that I am striving to have, and that is wisdom that leads to better decisions. You know, I want people around me who have some wisdom. Because, you know, I would be pretty cocky if I were to say, you know, I trust myself to make the right decisions all the time. I would be pretty cocky if I were to say that. A lot of people, you know what they like to do? They like to surround themselves with people who are not as smart as they are. Okay, you know why? Makes them look smarter. But you know what? It also leads to some pretty perilous circumstances because they wind up doing things that are pretty stupid a lot of times. Look at what Jesus said. Jesus had this way of expression. Of course, he's God, and you know it shouldn't surprise us all that much. But look at what he said. He had to blow the disciples away. After they had said, Lord, I don't think you really want to go to Judea. It's probably not a good idea. He said, look, are there not 12 hours of daylight? A man who walks by day will not stumble, for he sees by this world's light. It is when he walks by night that he stumbles, for he has no light. You see, many people, you know what we do? We choose to be around people who don't necessarily help us make the right decisions. Now, a lot of reasons for this. A lot of us are just natural rescuers. We get our significance by swooping in and saving people from their perils. Okay? If you talk to some of our Celebrate Recovery experts, they will tell you that another word for that is codependency. Am I right? And that's something that we tend to allow us to get our significance. We get so into the need because we have this great need to be needed ourselves. We choose to look and we try to get engaged in situations that are unhealthy already for the people that are in them. And even though we have really good intentions, we wind up getting sucked in. And we wind up losing energy and we wind up getting hurt sometimes because of that. So that's one of the ways that we can tend to in a very honest way, in a well-meaning way, we get into situations with others that help that keep us from making really good decisions. So then in verse 11, it says that after he had said this, Jesus went on to tell them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up. Jesus knew already by this time that Lazarus had died. And then in verse 12 through 20, we see a little bit more of the story where the disciples said, Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better, right? In other words, when he said sleep, the disciples were thinking, well, you know, if you got a cold, you got a flu, rest, sleep, and you'll get better, right? They didn't realize that by this time that he was dead. So then he told them plainly in verse 14, he's dead. And for your sake, I'm glad I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So now let's go to Lazarus, Jesus says. He's my friend. And so Thomas, who was also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. See, Thomas had a little bit of an insight. Because he knew, he was one of the disciples who apparently understood that this next trip to Jerusalem would be the last one. When they go to Judea, they go to Jerusalem, that would be the last one. Let us go die with him. So by the time Jesus got there in Bethany, which was in Judea, he had been dead 4 days. 4 days. And so we then see how Mary and Martha respond. And that gives us the third attribute that we want to look for and that we want to have in our search for, in our practice at being a good friend. And that's to understand that healthy emotional balance, we need to have healthy emotional balance that stays steady when the times are tough. Healthy emotional balance. Now, our emotions, folks, can control us easily. Many people are driven by emotions. Nothing wrong with emotions. Emotions are great, but you got to have a head. You got to kind of have a head and a heart balance, right? But when your head's off and you don't focus on truth and you try to balance your head with untruth, with emotions, things really get detrimental. They really get hazardous then. That's why it's so critically important for us to understand what Scripture says, okay? Because here lies the truth, right? That's where it's resonant. So even in grief, we're going to see how Martha keeps a little bit of a level head. Now, if you remember, Martha was the one who was always task-oriented. For her, productivity came before relationship. On the other hand, Mary seemed to have more of a relational type style, and productivity wasn't quite as important to her. So in verses 21 and 22, Martha says to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." My brother's dead, Lord, but you know what? Whatever your will is good enough. It's okay. It's okay. Martha had a healthy emotional balance. Her emotions were, she was hurting because of the death of her brother. But you know what? She also knew that this Jesus, who had yet to be crucified and had yet to be resurrected, she knew that he held everything in his hands. She had a faith that came out of a healthy emotional balance. And other stories that we read about her lead us to believe that she was a pretty doggone healthy lady for the most part. But here's what we need to do. We need to make sure that we understand the emotional aspects of relationships and of friendships. This means that we have to be careful, particularly about things, understanding the rules of female and male, right? How we've got to be very careful to understand friendship in the context between genders, right? It's one thing for me to be friends with my buddy Gene Terrell, right? You know, we kind of know how to be guys. We can be guys, right? But, you know, when we kind of cross that gender line, you got to be careful, don't you? Because, you know what, God created something called romantic love, right? It's different. It's a little different. I believe the term is eros in the Greek. And it was intended to be romantic. And so there can be a natural attraction. That's why we are constantly telling folks, we're constantly talking in staff, we're constantly talking to people in our congregation about the need to be aware of what we call not physical affairs, but those too, but even more so than that, emotional affairs. Emotional affairs occur between men and women whenever one or the other becomes emotionally dependent upon the other. And that can lead, you know, I've seen emotional affairs lead to just as much damage, really, as physical affairs. Because it's still unfaithfulness. It's still infidelity. Because it's almost like, okay, if I don't buy into the idea that an emotional affair is wrong, then that's almost like saying, well, okay, for me and my spouse, for example, it's okay for me just to us to exchange our bodies, our minds and our souls. We can share those. But the only reason we need to be monogamous is for physical purposes. That just doesn't seem right. Jesus said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, body, soul, just go on, spirit, you know, everything you got," right? And that is the way that we are to behave in our relationships, all right? Male, female, remember these hazards. These can be very difficult, and you know what? They're so subtle. Well-meaning people. "Oh, I just needed some help because, you know what, she was having a difficult time in her marriage, and I just wanted to help." Do not, guys, ever get caught in that. Ladies, do not get caught in the guy at the office who's having problems and just needs a friend of the opposite gender to talk to. That's not you. Tell them to go find a counselor or something if they need somebody from the opposite gender in a controlled environment. Okay? Do not allow that to happen. At the office, over social media, over the phone, whatever the case may be, do not do it. Well, we tend to overestimate our power to resist temptation. Have you ever realized that? We tend to think we're stronger than we really are. And you know what? That comes back to bite us so often. Well, Jesus said to her, you know, your brother's going to rise again. He will rise again. And that's largely an exchange that we see beginning in verse 23 between Mary and Martha and Jesus. And basically, we see Jesus now where Martha had come to greet him, but now Mary comes to be with him. And so Jesus now, meets Mary, and we see in the fourth piece, in beginning in verse 32, the fourth element that we need to consider looking for and also exhibiting if we're going to be good friends, and that's an empathetic spirit that shares in others' emotional joy and pain. You see, oftentimes we are willing, we're more than willing to share in the joy, but you know what? To share in the pain is a little bit difficult. Sometimes we don't know what to say when the emotional pain is there, and so we withdraw, when withdrawing is the worst thing we can do. Now, the second worst thing we can do is to stay, but we say a bunch of stuff. Does that make sense? Because a lot of times there are no words to say. And we get ourselves in trouble when we try to say things just to be saying things, thinking we're saying what the other person's needing in their pain. But a lot of times people in pain don't need you to say much of anything. That's when we need to pray, Lord, let my words be few. Because a lot of times we can say more that can be damaging. I had an experience Friday of having been requested to do the memorial service of a lady who used to go to church here years ago and has been in church since. But I learned a couple years ago she had cancer and didn't realize how far it had progressed. Kind of lost touch until I was called last week and I went to visit her Friday afternoon. And she was obviously just dazed from death. And her questions all had to do with death. What can I expect? What can I look at? What's on the other side? What should I be doing right now? And she could barely talk because of her weakness. And you know what? That was a time when she requested where I spoke quite a bit. And I had to say, God, give me the words to say because I don't know how to deal with this. I really don't know how to deal with this. But there is where I had to speak. But otherwise, normally, unless she had asked for those words, what do you say? A lot of times just being there is so critically important. So we need to have an empathetic spirit that shares in others' emotional joy and pain. In verses 32 and beyond, when Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. Jesus himself demonstrates the empathetic spirit that we need to have. We need to be willing to cry with people. You want to be a friend? You got to be willing to cry with people. You want to look for friends around you who are willing to cry with you. Now, crying is not always a physical manifestation. We can emotionally cry without seeing the tears, believe it or not. Right? But guys, that doesn't mean that just because you're a guy, you're not supposed to cry the tears. All right? Crying when you feel like crying is one of the most masculine things you can do. Masculinity and femininity has nothing to do with the withholding of the expression of emotion. So please, don't get into that. Your wives sometimes need to see you cry. You know? They need to know that you're a real man who can do that. So after this, Jesus raises Lazarus. The Jews then heard of it, and they plot even more to kill him. And so we're going to jump down to the last part of verse 11. Everybody's happy because Lazarus has been raised from the dead. And we see all these things that Jesus needs to, that Jesus gives us, that we see between him and the relationship between Mary and Martha and the disciples so far. And then we learn about this fifth piece that we need to make sure that we have and that we look for, and that's a sense of loyalty that sticks during the tough times. Now, this is a lot like the first one we talked about. This is a lot like the very first attribute that we mentioned earlier, having the courage to move forward in difficult situations. But here, I want to look for friends, and if I'm going to be a friend, I want to be the friend who will stick with folks through loyalty. With my loyalty, I'm sticking with them through the tough times all the way through the way. The disciples, here we see that although in the end, a week later, they would desert him, here they stayed with him. They committed to stay with him, even though it would have been easy to desert him. In verses 53 and 54, from that day on, the Jews plotted to take Jesus' life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the Jews. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the desert, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. The disciples were a good bunch of guys. Sometimes we really get hard on them because, you know, they did desert Jesus in the end. They did desert Jesus in the end. But, you know, they were really good guys who understood what it meant to be a friend, and they stayed with him. Finally, there needs to be a time-tested commitment to the relationship. I would dare say that you cannot call somebody a friend, or you cannot be called a friend, until there has been significant time passed in the relationship to demonstrate real friendship over time. Heard of fair weather friends? Right? We know folks that kind of turn and run when things get a little tough, right? Well, we fast forward into the next few days. Jesus, the experience with Lazarus is over. And he rides into Jerusalem in chapter 12. And we see what the Bible tells us about the crowd that saw him coming in. John 12, verse 12. The next day, the great crowd that had come for the feast heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. They took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel." Great triumphant scene that would result less than a week later in many of the very same people saying what? Crucify him. Crucify him. You see, the crowds in Jerusalem that day were a reminder that friendship can be fleeting. That friendship is indeed time-tested. It's not fickle. But rather, it's something that causes us, that compels us to move forward through difficult times and not change horses. So what kind of friend are you? What kind of friend are you? Now, just by virtue of the fact that you're here today, probably is a pretty good indication that you might be a pretty good friend, or at least you want to be, okay? Because if you're here today, that kind of gives me a little bit of an indication, hope that, you know, the things of God are important to you, or at least you're trying to make them important to you. And, you know, that's a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful thing. You see, I believe that you cannot be a fully functional Christian, a Christ follower, who is following the tenets of Jesus Christ, unless you have relationships that are modeling these attributes and many more. You see, it's one thing to say I'm a Christ follower. You know, if I don't have relationships around me to demonstrate that, I would say it's highly unlikely that you're really moving toward being who God wants you to be. Now let me say this. It's okay for introverts and extroverts to understand the differences. Extroverts are likely to have more friends than introverts. That's because introverts by nature, they find people drain them. Not that the people do, but they just don't have the capacity for the interpersonal relationships. But they have fewer and deeper friends. Extroverts might have longer, but you know, or not longer, but more plentiful, but maybe the broader relationships, perhaps. Me and my wife are perfect examples. I'm the classic extrovert. She's the classic introvert. So don't let that, if you're an introvert, don't feel bad if you can say, I've only got 1, 2, 3 close friends. That might be more than most introverts have. So don't understand your context and your personality. But more than that, understand what it means to be a friend and what it takes for others for you to look for in them. Because the best way for you to be a friend is to develop relationships with those who already know how and learn from them. So what's it going to be for you? Is there somebody in your life that needs to have more of you as a friend? Is there someone that could benefit from something you can give them in a friend relationship? I would encourage you to think about that person while we're praying today and ask God what you would do this week, what He would have you do to live into that person's life in a positive way. The other thing is this. I want you to examine your own standards for people and friends and ask God, do I need to really upgrade my standards? Am I looking for the right things? Life was meant to be lived in community, in relationship with one another, flowing out of a relationship with Jesus Christ. Father, thank you for relationships. God, thank you for friendships. And Lord, I pray right now that you will challenge us to think of someone in our lives who needs us to be more of a friend this week. Maybe somebody who's going through a difficult time. Maybe someone who just needs some advice in order to know which way to go to perhaps avoid a difficult situation. Lord, maybe someone who we know doesn't have a lot of friends necessarily, or maybe they're new to the area or they're new to the workplace. Lord, maybe whatever situation there may be, God, reveal that person to us now individually here and today. And God, show us that person. Show us their face. Call to our remembrance their name. Maybe they're an acquaintance and maybe we don't really know them yet, but we need to get to know them. God, just lay on our hearts those people that you want us to be cognizant of and that you want us to be aware of. At the same time, God, speak to us about our ability and our tendency to exhibit these characteristics, these attributes of friendship. Show us, Lord, what you want us to live out and how you want us to magnify you. God, because we do that so much through the way that we have interpersonal dealings with other people. So God, grow us and show us your heart. Show us your way. Make us more and more willing to be friends just like you. God, to model the relationships that we see with you and Mary and Martha and Lazarus, Lord, the disciples. And God, at the same time, to understand that there is no room for fickleness in friendship. Relationships are meant to be rich. Thank you for them. So God, grow us in this way. No matter our age, we have so much further. So we have so much headroom in which we can grow. Because in the end, we want to be a friend like you. Give us that heart. Give us that desire. Change us from the inside out. Thank you, for it's in Christ's name that we pray. Amen. Well, again, thanks for being here with us today. I want to give you a couple things just real quick before you leave. I know it's running behind a little bit. We've got tickets for sale for the benefit for Tim Bevel, who is fighting mantle cell lymphoma. You saw Tim on the screen earlier reading from Isaiah chapter 53. And that was not a prop. That's Tim reading what he believes about God and healing. So for $10, you can purchase that for the O'Charlie's fundraiser on March 12th. All-you-can-eat brunch there. Right back there, Ms. Sheila Fonrich, the lovely Ms. Sheila Fonrich, is at the welcome booth to sell your ticket to you. Let's pick those up. Also, come back for the luncheon that we're going to have today. We may be, weather permitting, outside in the parking lot. We got tables set up out there, and hopefully we're going to be able to leave them out there. Don't forget to drop your connection cards. I didn't ask you to fill those out earlier, but please do that. Take a moment before you leave. Fill those out. Let us know prayer requests, needs you have, and drop those in the boxes in the back along with your tithes and your offering. Thank you again for your generosity this past week, and I pray that you will continue that, to have the faith that God will bless you when you choose to bless others with your generosity. God bless. Have a great day and a great week. Hope to see you back after church today, after the second service, for that lunch together. God bless. Bye-bye.